Serbs called Bosnians aliens. Slave owners throughout history considered slaves subhuman animals. I think what really struck me as I was rereading this passage that I just shared with you from Braving the Wilderness, and then I'm looking at the new research on dehumanization, what struck me is that the language we use to dehumanize is effective because it actually taps into core disgust. We reduce people to the types of things that make us physically recoil, like we do from cockroaches, rats, you know, infestations. We reduce people into the things that make us grossed out. As we close this section on dehumanization and we think about contempt, disgust, one of the arguments of this book is that language matters. It's the raw material of story. It changes how we feel about ourselves and others, and it's a portal to connection. With the same amount of power, language can also be used to strip people of their dignity and humanity. With awareness about how dehumanization works, comes the responsibility on all of us to call out dangerous language when we recognize it. We have two more sections in this chapter. The next one is hate, and the last one is self-righteousness. Let's look at hate first. I open this section on hate with a quote from Why We Hate by Agneta Fischer, Iran Halperin, Daphna Canetti, and Alba Jassini. Here's the quote. Hatred will always motivate people for destructive action. According to researcher Robert Sternberg, hate is a combination of various negative emotions, including repulsion, disgust, anger, fear, and contempt. We feel hate toward individuals or groups that we believe are intentionally malicious and unlikely to change. What's interesting is that we can develop hate toward people we don't know personally simply based on their affiliation with a group or ideology that doesn't align with our beliefs. Research shows that a lack of direct contact with such individuals can actually strengthen hate. This completely confirms my belief that people are harder to hate close up and easier to hate when we're behind our ideological bunker and they're behind theirs. What's really fascinating is that hate is actually fueled by our need for connection. I'm going to read that sentence again. What's really fascinating is that hate is actually fueled by our need for connection. So for many years, I've called this common enemy intimacy. I may not know anything about you, but we hate the same people, and that creates a counterfeit bond and a sense of belonging. You know, I say counterfeit because the bond and belonging are not real. They hinge on my agreeing with you and not challenging the ideas that connect us. It's not true belonging. Sternberg found that hate moves from place to place on a current, and it needs this current to grow and travel. He explains that, quote, those currents are provided by cynical leaders who capitalize on people's insecurities to bolster their own power. He goes on and says, when instigators seek to gain traction for their leadership by spreading hate, they often attract observers who do nothing or who over time move from being observers to being participant observers or to being active participants. Sternberg also states that, quote, the more the leaders whip up powerful stories, even ones of hate, the more people follow them. Here's what we know from the research. Hate crime victims, quote, generally have not done anything specific. They are terrorized for who they are, not what they've done. Close quote. For me, this immediately brings to mind all of the innocent trans people, particularly trans Black women, who have been targeted, beaten, and killed, not because of anything they've done, but because of who they are. In an interview with The Daily Beast, the actress and activist and my friend, Laverne Cox, talks about the documentary Disclosure, which addresses the dehumanization of trans people. Laverne explains, quote, This is what our film tries to grapple with, this paradox of visibility, that we're potentially more targeted because we're more visible. And so then the need for justice, the need for real justice and understanding and hearts and minds to be changed so that the existence of a trans person doesn't cause someone to react in a way that the trans person might lose their life. The research that I found the most devastating explained that, quote, the goal of hate is not merely to hurt, but to ultimately eliminate or destroy the target, either mentally, through humiliation, treasuring feelings of revenge, socially, excluding or ignoring, or physically, killing, torturing, which may be accompanied by the goal to let the wrongdoer suffer. I'm going to read a cleaner version of the sentence to you without the examples of what physically, mentally, or socially is, just so you can get the impact of the sentence, because it is bone-chilling to me. The goal of hate is not merely to hurt, but to ultimately eliminate or destroy the target, either mentally, socially, or physically, which may be accompanied by the goal to let the wrongdoer suffer. This makes me want to return to the days when I had toddlers and we banned the word hate from our house and my vocabulary. If this is not enough to do that, I don't know what is. Hate crimes are meant to terrorize more than a single person. The goal is to embed fear so deeply in the heart of a community that fear becomes a crushing way of life for everyone who shares that identity. There is no simple way to stop hate. However, the researcher Sternberg explains, quote, it's not clear that there's any magic bullet for curing hate, but any mechanism that helps one understand things from others' points of view, love, critical thinking, wisdom, engagement with members of target groups, at least makes hate less likely, because it is harder to hate people if you understand that in many respects, they are not also different from you. Let's talk about self-righteousness. I'm opening this section in the book with a quote from John Mark Green. The self-righteous scream judgments against others to hide the noise of the skeletons dancing in their own closets. I can tell you exactly what I was wearing and where I was sitting 25 years ago when someone in an AA meeting said, part of my sobriety is letting go of self-righteousness. It's really hard because it feels so good, like a pig rolling in shit. I remember thinking at the time, oh God, I'm not sure exactly what that means, but I think I roll around in that shit too. From that day forward, I started thinking of self-righteousness as a threat to my self-respect, my well-being, and my sobriety. Unfortunately, it's virtually impossible to add it to the abstinence list. It's not as binary as having or not having a Bud Light or a cigarette. But I definitely see it as a slippery behavior that necessitates some really serious self-reflection and possibly amends. According to researchers, self-righteousness is the conviction that one's beliefs and behaviors are the most correct. People who exhibit self-righteousness see things as black and white. They tend to be closed-minded, inflexible, intolerant of ambiguity, and less likely to consider others' opinions. It's important to realize that self-righteousness is different from righteousness. In the case of righteousness, we are appropriately reacting to a true injustice. We are trying to do the right thing. When feeling self-righteous, we feel morally superior to others and, get this, are trying to convince ourselves or others that we're doing the right thing. Moral outrage in response to injustice can be classified as righteous anger when it's motivated by a true concern about injustice. But when moral outrage is self-enhancing, it is self-righteous anger. I wish I had understood all of this better back then, especially the difference between self-righteousness and righteousness. I always thought about self-righteousness in terms of terminal uniqueness. It's a term from the recovery movement that means you think you're different from everyone else. You're the exception. Your addiction struggle is the exception. Your story is the exception, and so on. I didn't know what I know now. I just told myself that I needed more humility and less thinking that I was better than, more right, and always the exception. I had to stop assuming that people who disagreed with me didn't care about people or issues as much as I did. It's so funny to me how thinking I'm better than can slip so quickly into I'm worthless. I mean, in seconds, in mere seconds. And I think letting go of I'm better than slowly releases us from those experiences of I'm worthless. Given the political climate today, it's important to understand that moral outrage is self-enhancing and related to self-righteous anger. I've had to be super conscientious about the moral outrage and instead focus on doing the next right thing. If there's anything that looks and feels like a pig rolling in shit these days, it's performative moral outrage, especially on social media. Chapter 13, places we go to self-assess, pride, hubris, and humility. Unless you want to be swept away in a sea of inspirational Pinterest quotes, do not Google pride and humility. From Bible verses to the worst 1980s corporate motivational posters, everyone seems to have an opinion about the importance of humility and the dangerous nature of pride. You don't see too many inspirational quotes about hubris, but if you search political news articles from 2016 to 2020, you will be swallowed whole. But here's the thing, most of the quotes have it wrong. Let's break it down, and then we'll get into each one of them separately, but I think it's important to go through pride, hubris, and humility comparatively together off the bat. Pride is a feeling of pleasure or celebration related to our accomplishments or efforts. Hubris is an inflated sense of one's own innate abilities that's tied more to the need for dominance than to actual accomplishments. And then humility is an openness to new learning combined with a balanced and accurate assessment of our contributions, including our strengths, imperfections, and opportunities for growth. We actually really get all three of them wrong, so let's talk about it. Start with pride. Pride is a feeling of pleasure or celebration related to our accomplishments or efforts. Many researchers distinguish hubris from pride by referring to the pride we experience when we've accomplished something as authentic pride. Authentic pride typically has a positive connotation and descriptors that include words like accomplishment, mastery, triumph, confidence, and self-worth. It is positively associated with self-esteem and negatively associated with shame proneness. Researchers Lisa Williams and Joel Davies explain that we don't just feel pride about our own accomplishments. There is a, quote, family of pride experiences. I can feel proud of myself, proud of you, proud of us. If you take in the research across the board, authentic pride or feeling good about what we accomplish is a healthy thing. However, Rhonda Deering, a researcher from our team, points out there's another common way that we sometimes use the word pride that doesn't really fit with the research or with our experiences. People commonly say things like pride got in the way, for example, when someone fresh out of college turned down a job that they felt overqualified for, or we might say he was too proud to accept help when a single dad is struggling financially and turns down his parents' offer of a temporary loan. After rumbling on this use, we agreed that context and story are necessary to figure out what's driving these behaviors. It could be anything. It could be hubris, fear, shame, defensiveness. The learning here is to stay curious when we see or experience these kind of behaviors. They really don't fit with pride or authentic pride, and there's probably more to a story when someone turns down a job or refuses help. This one just shook me. This is hubris. Let's talk about it. Hubris is an inflated sense of one's own innate abilities that's tied more to the need for dominance than to actual accomplishments. It is negatively correlated with self-esteem and positively correlated with narcissism and shame proneness. In simpler terms, the higher the hubris, the lower the self-esteem, and the higher the hubris, the higher the narcissism and shame proneness. Dominance, which is a type of status that is coerced through aggression or intimidation, plays a significant role in hubris. Okay, I'm just telling y'all, I had no idea that there was anything about dominance underneath the hood of hubris. But researchers write, quote, "Hubristic pride may have evolved to motivate behaviors, thoughts, and feelings oriented toward attaining dominance, whereas authentic pride may have evolved to motivate behaviors, thoughts, and feelings oriented with attaining prestige." Now, I'm not crazy about the word prestige. It sounds arrogant, but it's helpful to know that in the research, prestige status is earned. Prestige-based leaders are admired for skills or knowledge, which is distinct from dominant status, which is obtained by force. To those of us observing hubris, it looks and feels terrible. However, to the person experiencing hubris, it feels good. They puff up and feel blustery and superior. Furthermore, the person experiencing hubris does not really care what we think. Researchers found that hubris can increase levels of dominance, and interestingly, dominance, quote, does not require respect or social acceptance. So when you watch someone do something out of sheer hubris and you think to yourself, God, don't they see how badly this is being received? Remember, it doesn't have to be received well for them to feel good about it. As I mentioned earlier, hubris is positively correlated with narcissism. In Daring Greatly, I write about how everything from Facebook and influencer culture to the increasingly insane behavior of politicians has pushed the term narcissism into the zeitgeist. While it's penetrated social consciousness enough that most people correctly associate it with a pattern of behaviors that include grandiosity, a pervasive need for admiration, and a lack of empathy, almost no one understands how every level of severity in this diagnosis is underpinned by shame. Narcissism is shame-based. In fact, I define narcissism as the shame-based fear of being ordinary. In the book, I have a note to readers that says, read this paragraph slowly, then reread it. It's mind-blowing. So let's do it together. Research led by Jessica Tracy found that, quote, for the narcissist, positive views of the self are too essential to leave to the whim of actual accomplishments, for they are what prevent the individual from succumbing to shame and low self-esteem. Instead, narcissists come to experience a globalized, hubristic pride, characterized by feelings of arrogance and egotism, which is distinct from the more achievement-based and pro-social authentic pride. Let me just read this to you again. This is research by Jessica Tracy. I'm going to kind of translate it for you. So for the narcissist, it's so essential that they have positive views about themselves, that they disconnect their view of themselves from any actual accomplishment of anything. Because if they tied how they viewed themselves to what they actually accomplished, it'd be too easy to succumb to shame and low self-esteem. So leaving this section on hubris, hubris sounds like an almost foolproof way to assert yourself in the world. No accomplishments, no respect, no social acceptance needed. You would, however, have to hone your bullying skills and be open to being seen as an asshole. The price, in addition to the aforementioned downsides, is that folks with trait hubristic pride are more likely to experience chronic anxiety, engage in aggression and hostility, and struggle with intimate partner relationships and general social support. What does hubris actually look like? Researchers say that it mirrors the physical patterns of dominance display, The head has a downward rather than upward tilt. There's a widened stance and less smiling. Between you and me, I have to say it's not a stretch to try to picture it. Last, let's talk about humility. I'm ending this section with humility to give you something more uplifting. While the origin of the word hubris is Greek and was used to describe a pride and an ambition so great that they offend the gods and led to one's downfall, humility comes from the Latin word humilitas, meaning groundedness. Humility is quieter, but more genuine and ultimately more powerful than hubris. And as with pride, we've got a lot of it wrong. Humility is openness to new learning combined with a balanced and accurate assessment of our contributions, including our strengths, imperfections, and opportunities for growth. I can sum up humility with one sentence that emerged from the research that informed Dare to Lead. I'm here to get it right, not to be right. This is where we make the mistake, so let's talk about what humility isn't. Humility is not downplaying yourself or your accomplishments, which, according to researchers, is modesty, not humility. Humility is also not low self-esteem or meekness or letting people walk all over you. The emotion of humility involves understanding our contributions in context, in relation to both the contributions of others and our own place in the universe. It's different from pride in that when we feel pride, we focus entirely on the positive aspects of a specific accomplishment, which, again, can still be really healthy and productive. The term intellectual humility refers specifically to a willingness to consider information that doesn't fit with our current thinking. People who demonstrate intellectual humility don't lack confidence or conviction. They may hold very strong views, but they're just also open to understanding other points of view. They are curious and willing to adjust their beliefs when faced with new or conflicting information. Humility allows us to admit when we're wrong. We realize that getting it right is more important than needing to prove that we are right. As we leave this section, hopefully we can also leave behind the ideas that hubris is just a benign form of supersized pride. We can leave behind the fact that this idea that pride's bad for us and that humility is weakness. Pride can be good for us. Hubris is dangerous. And humility is key to grounded confidence and healthy relationships. We have arrived at the final chapter of the book, Cultivating Meaningful Connection. And I start with a conversation about theory. To open up this conversation about theory, I start with a quote from Arthur Conan Doyle in his book, A Scandal in Bohemia. He writes, "It is a capital mistake to theorize before one has data. Insensibly, one begins to twist facts to suit theories instead of theories to suit facts." I will never forget the day when Dr. Paul Raphael, my epistemology professor, drew the circle of science on the board. It was my first class in the social work doctoral program at the University of Houston, and seeing that circle on the board felt like a moment from a Dan Brown book. It was the PhD student's first clue to finding the inner sanctum. Dr. Raphael was one of the few faculty members that I continued to address as doctor, even after I was hired as a tenure-track assistant professor and we became colleagues. He always wore a suit and tie with a coordinating University of Houston baseball cap, and he always had a twinkle in his eye when he talked about that circle of science. It was like he was thinking, "You have no idea what I'm talking about right now. Oh, but you will. All will be revealed." So in the book, I have a picture of this circle, but I can describe it to you really easily. It's basically an arrow that starts at the top and then goes down the right side, and then another arrow that starts at the bottom and goes up the left side. And so what it describes is the relationship between deductive reasoning and inductive reasoning. And so at the very top, you have a theory. And say you start research with a theory. And some people want to prove or disprove the theory using deductive reasoning. So they go down and they're testing a theory. Natural blondes are taller than natural redheads. And so they're deductively testing this. That's a type of research, usually quantitative research. Qualitative research is starting from the bottom and developing a theory based on observations. And so the reason why this circle of science is important is because I didn't know that there were two ways to do research when I started this program, and I became a qualitative or inductive researcher. And so it became essential to me. As a grounded theory researcher, I work up from the bottom of that circle, following an inductive approach in generating theories from mostly qualitative data. I'll occasionally use quantitative methods for something, but I love language and words and story. The theories that I develop are then often tested using deductive and quantitative methods. Some old school deductive folks argue that their approach is the most valuable, but today there's a widely held belief that we need both. We should not test and build on theories that are just conjecture, especially when it comes to hypothesizing about underrepresented groups while knowing very little about their stories and lived experiences. Having a empirically based theory adds to the rigor of science. This is the value of the full circle. P.S. I think the circle of science would be way more popular if we had like an Elton John song like the Circle of Life, but it was like, the circle of science. The word theory is also not as complicated as it sounds. We all have theories. For example, you probably have a theory about the traffic patterns by your house, or the reason one team at work is always late delivering projects, or why your parents get to the airport 6 hours before their flight departs. We theorize all day long. I think the best definition of theory is from the behavioral scientist Fred Kerlinger. P.S. This is something else I learned from Dr. Raffel and his course. Kerlinger defines theory as a set of interrelated concepts, definitions, and propositions that present a systematic view of something while specifying the relationships between all the variables. And the purpose of a theory is to explain and predict phenomenon. If you break down your theory about the traffic patterns in your neighborhood, it will more than likely include propositions and concepts that come together to paint a picture of what's going on. For example, the number of cars at the high rise down the street, the line getting out of the grocery store, the need for a light at a busy intersection, the new school zone. Theorizing is just a part of meaning making. It's how we explain the relationships between different variables. The only difference between our everyday theories about how things work and the inductive research I do is that my theories are based on observations or data that we methodically collect and analyze. We observe the traffic, count the cars, pull data from the city, time the lights, review accident reports, interview neighbors, and generate a theory or a hypothesis. If we do this, then this. Or these changes will have a positive effect on this. Once the theory is out in the world, my research colleagues may come behind me and test that theory deductively by temporarily setting up stop signs or traffic lights and analyzing the outcome. Part of the beauty of the circle of science is its iterative nature. Researchers test and retest from the bottom up and from the top down. The findings evolve and our level of understanding keeps getting closer and closer to, I think, what we loosely call truth. It may seem as if the findings are changing or the initial findings were wrong, but often it's the case that new data has given us a more accurate understanding of the data that came before. This, my friends, is the circle of science. By the way, I'm going to totally ask Elton John and Brandi Carlile to do a duet on this. Stay tuned on TikTok. I'm going to do it. So now that I've forced you through a primer on theory building, I'm going to share a new theory with you that's the culmination of my work since the beginning, and I do mean the very beginning, the very start. My dissertation is actually on connection, and this new work is a theory on cultivating meaningful connection. While this theory draws heavily on all of my previous work, there was something missing, a piece that I couldn't quite figure out until I started this research. That elusive piece was rediscovering the Buddhist concept of near enemies. studying near enemies took me down the research rabbit hole, and the more I read, the more I realized that for years, I've been underestimating this concept's power and the contribution it can make to explaining human behavior. I explain the concept of near enemies in chapter 7, where we talk about pity being the near enemy of compassion. But before we get into the new theory, I want to dig deeper. Several writers and researchers whose work I admire and turn to often, including Kristen Neff, Chris Germer, and Jack Kornfield, write about near enemies. To get our heads and hearts around this concept, I thought I'd share a different definition and a couple of examples. In an incredibly timely and powerful article, The Near and Far Enemies of Fierce Compassion, Chris Germer writes, "Near enemies are states that appear similar to the desired quality, but actually undermine it. Far enemies are the opposite of what we're trying to achieve. For example, a near enemy of loving kindness is sentimentality. It's similar, but different. A far enemy of loving kindness is ill will, the opposite of loving kindness. Another example is that a near enemy of compassion is pity, and the far enemy is cruelty. Without the language of near and far enemies, and without the tools of emotional granularity and self-awareness, the difference between how we want to show up and the near enemies of these practices feels nuanced. But this type of nuance predicts the difference between wholeheartedness and brokenheartedness. Jack Kornfield explains that near enemies may seem like the qualities that we believe are important and may even be mistaken for them, but they are different and often undermine our practices. He writes, quote, "The near enemies depict how spirituality can be misunderstood or misused to separate us from life." When I read that last sentence, I had to break it down and reread it, I'm not even kidding y'all, 20 times. The near enemies depict how spirituality can be misunderstood or misused to separate us from life. I define spirituality as the deeply held belief that we are inextricably connected to each other by something greater than ourselves. I have friends who are atheists who every day practice inextricable connection. They hurt when others hurt, and they know that none of us are free until all of us are free. I also have friends who talk endlessly about their religion and wear scripture on their t-shirts, yet demonstrate no connection to anyone's suffering but their own, and maybe that of the people in their immediate circle. I make this point because we're not talking about religion here. We're talking about the irrepressible human spirit. When I look at Kornfield's sentence and think about my 20-plus years of research on connection, here's my translation. On the surface, the near enemies of emotions or experiences might look and even feel like connection, but ultimately, they drive us to be disconnected from ourselves and from each other. Without awareness, near enemies become the practices that fuel separation rather than practices that reinforce the inextricable connection of all people. I mean, this is huge. To really get this concept in our bones, I want to share two more examples with you from Jack Kornfield. On love, Jack Kornfield writes, "The near enemy of love is attachment. Attachment masquerades as love. It says, I will love this person because I need something from them, or I will love you if you love me back. I'll love you, but only if you will be the way I want you to be." This is not the fullness of love. Instead, there's attachment, there's clinging and fear. True love allows, honors, and appreciates. Attachment grasps, demands, needs, and aims to possess. On equanimity, Kornfield writes, "The near enemy of equanimity is indifference or callousness. We may appear serene if we say, I'm not attached. It doesn't matter what happens anyway because it's all transitory. We feel a certain peaceful relief because we withdraw from experience and from the energies of life. But indifference is based on fear. True equanimity is not a withdrawal, It's a balanced engagement with all aspects of life. It's opening to the whole of life with composure and ease of mind, accepting the beautiful and terrifying nature of all things. I needed the concept of near enemies because when it comes to cultivating meaningful connection, the far enemies, the real opposites, are not what get in the way most of the time. They're easy to recognize. We don't get tricked into believing that everything is okay. The far enemies are upfront with their disconnection. It's the near enemies of connection, the imposters, that can look and feel like cultivating closeness, that sabotage relationships and leave us feeling alone and in pain. And because they're so stealthy, we often internalize the pain and think that something's wrong with us. Near enemies can feel like manipulation and even gaslighting. Of course, the far enemies can destroy connection too, but you see them coming. All right, let's jump into this new theory that I was able to develop after literally it's probably been 22 or 23 years that I've been working on it since my dissertation, but I didn't have this concept of near enemy, so I just never could complete it. Every book I write, I think the back of this book is going to include this new theory, but this is the first time because I found near enemy. So this is a grounded theory on cultivating meaningful connection. And meaningful connection is a daring and vulnerable practice that requires grounded confidence, the courage to walk alongside others, and story stewardship. So three big pieces to cultivating connection: grounded confidence, the courage to walk alongside others, and story stewardship. In the book, there's a very, five-page long graphic of this theory laid out. And we're going to walk through it together. And what's helpful now is I don't even think we could have walked through it had we not just learned about these 87 experiences and emotions, because they fill in all of the pieces of this theory. But there will also be some new concepts too. And so as we talk about the theory, you'll see that each of the three major categories, the grounded confidence, the courage to walk alongside others, and story stewardship, all have near enemies and far enemies, as do each of the skills that support these categories. Okay, let's start with developing grounded confidence. And again, this may be a part of the audiobook that you want to listen to and then grab the PDF that came with the audiobook, because there is like a full kind of layout of the theory, but we're going to talk through it. So I first introduced the term grounded confidence in Dare to Lead. The core learning in Dare to Lead is that it's not fear that gets in the way of courage. It's armor. It's how we self-protect when we feel uncertain or fearful. Armoring behaviors keep us from showing up in ways that are aligned with our values. As we learn to recognize and remove the armor, we replace it with grounded confidence. This concept of grounded confidence was really in its infancy when I wrote about it several years ago. It only included three properties: the ability to rumble with vulnerability, to stay curious, and to practice new skills. What you see now as part of this theory is a much fuller concept with more properties. And to be honest with you, my guess is that we'll continue to work on this for years to come. So let's walk through some of what it means to develop grounded confidence. This is a type of confidence that's driven by a commitment to learning and improving. The near enemy of learning and improving is knowing and proving. In our culture, where we're quick to mistake knowing and proving for confidence, when they're actually a function of low self-worth, this is a big thing. So let me say it to you again. The near enemy of grounded confidence is knowing and proving, because grounded confidence is built on learning and improving. The far enemy of grounded confidence is a fragile self-worth. And it's that fragile self-worth that drives us to self-protect at all costs. Some of the skill sets for developing grounded confidence, in addition to this learning and improving, include knowing and applying the language of human experience and emotion, which is what we're doing together in this book, practicing courage, knowing how to rumble with vulnerability, staying curious, practicing humility. So what's the near enemy to practicing humility? Confusing modesty and insecurity with humility. What's the far enemy of practicing humility? Hustling and hubris. The last skill under the category of developing grounded confidence is feeling embodied and connected to self. We do not talk enough about the importance of embodiment and what happens to us when we're disconnected from our physical selves. In his book, The Body Keeps the Score, trauma researcher Bessel van der Kolk writes, "Trauma victims cannot recover until they become familiar with and befriend the sensations in their bodies. Being frightened means that you live in a body that's always on guard. Angry people live in angry bodies. The bodies of child abuse victims are tense and defensive until they find a way to relax and feel safe. In order to change, people need to become aware of their sensations and the way that their bodies interact with the world around them. Physical self-awareness is the first step in releasing the tyranny of the past," end quote. Van der Kolk goes on to explain that the mind needs to be re-educated to feel physical sensations, and the body needs to be helped to tolerate and enjoy the comforts of touch. That individuals who lack emotional awareness are able, with practice, to connect their physical sensations to psychological events. Then they can slowly reconnect with themselves. Grounded confidence is driven by learning and curiosity, even about our own bodies. For many of us, myself included, it's easier to live in our heads and be completely disconnected from our bodies. But there's a cost. Insomnia, injuries, exhaustion, depression, anxiety. The body has very powerful ways to get our attention. Prentice Hempel is a writer, an embodiment facilitator, a political organizer, and a therapist. They're the founder and director of the Embodiment Institute and the Black Embodiment Initiative. I've learned so much from Prentice about embodiment. I think their definitions will breathe some life into these words that you see on the model when you look at it. So Prentice defines embodiment as the awareness of our body's sensations, habits, and the beliefs that inform them. Embodiment requires the ability to feel and allow the body's emotions. This embodiment awareness is necessary to realign what we do with what we believe. Prentice defines disembodiment as an unawareness, repression, or denial of our sensations and emotions, and/or privileging our thinking over our feeling. Disembodiment often leads to an incongruence between the actions we take in the world and the beliefs that we hold. This piece about values misalignment from Prentice really makes sense to me because the best indicator light around being out of my values is actually my body. I can't quite describe it, but I feel out of sorts. Like you feel when you catch every red light on a long downtown street, like my body is out of flow. Prentice writes, quote, "The habits that become embodied in us are the ones that we practice the most often. And whether we are aware of it or not, we are always practicing something. When we are disembodied or disconnected from our own feelings and sensations, it's easy to become habituated to practices that we don't believe in or value. We become what we do, even when those things are outside of who we want to be. Our bodies are our teachers, and our body's the messenger who call out our attention to what we're absorbing and becoming. This is why we have to learn how to listen. This is why grounded confidence requires us to be embodied." Let's move to the second of the three skill sets that come together to make up cultivating meaningful connection, and that is practicing the courage to walk alongside. One of the great challenges in grounded theory is naming categories and properties in a way that accurately reflects the data and resonates with people's lived experiences. For this category, I found myself asking, what does it mean to be other-focused? To use language in the service of connecting, to be compassionate, empathic, and non-judgmental. As soon as I started thinking about this question, I was literally transported back to my dissertation. The name of the theory that emerged from my dissertation is acompañar. It means to accompany in Spanish. My dissertation is a study on how helping professionals build and maintain connection with the people they serve. The approach that best reflected what I learned from that data was the accompaniment movement, an organizing and social justice approach that comes out of liberation theology activism in Latin America. The work is a commitment to be with people, not pushing them from behind or leading them from the front, but walking with them in solidarity. Being other-focused, using language in the service of connecting, practicing compassion, empathy, and non-judgment, aren't fully in line with all of the tenets of accompaniment, but are fully consistent with practicing the courage to walk alongside. The near enemy of walking alongside is controlling the path. Sometimes it can look and feel like someone is with us, but they're trying to control either us or the outcome. I actually think that most of us do this way more than we'd like to admit. For example, my child comes home and is upset because they got in trouble at school. They were talking while the teacher was talking and they were told that their behavior was disrespectful. And I'm trying to be with them in this experience, but I quickly find myself worried about what the teacher will think of my child and worse, what they're going to think about me as a parent. So now, rather than being with my child, walking alongside my child, I'm trying to control how this is going to go. Forget about asking what happened or checking in to see how they're feeling. I want to walk alongside you turns into, you need to email your teacher and apologize right this minute. What were you thinking? I once heard Anne Lamott say, help is the sunny side of control. Yes, and yikes. All of us who were raised taking care of other people and trying to manage environments can default to wanting to control the path, regardless of our great intentions, especially when, quote, it's in everyone's best interest. The question is always, whose best interests are you protecting? Walking alongside is other-focused. Control is self-focused. This is where you can just, in your mind, insert the stressed emoji with that flat, panicked grin. We also see controlling the path in larger cultural contexts. For example, politicians who see people suffering, and rather than actually walking alongside them, make people feel like they're understood and they're not alone, while actually leveraging and exploiting their emotion for political gain and influence. I see your struggles and your pain. You don't deserve it. Here's to blame. And here's how I can help you. And here's how we can make them pay. This near enemy is so seductive that it's often as dangerous as the far enemy of having the courage to walk alongside, which is walking away from. Power is a really important element of walking alongside, and it's not one that we talk about often enough. I think it's because we have this weird negative reaction to the word power, even though everyone will tell you that powerlessness is one of the most painful human experiences. My favorite definition of power comes from Martin Luther King Jr. In a 1968 speech given to striking sanitation workers in Memphis, Reverend King defined power as the ability to achieve purpose and affect change. The definition doesn't make the nature of power inherently good or bad, which aligns with what I've learned in my work. What makes power dangerous is how it's used. Power over is dangerous because it's using disproportional influence to achieve gain, even when it diminishes the agency or dignity of other people. In their publication, Making Change Happen, Power, Just Associates, a global interdisciplinary network of activists, organizers, educators, and scholars, defines three variations of power within the context of social justice and activism. These are so helpful. Whether we're talking about social justice or we're just talking about this whole idea of making meaningful connection. So power with is based on mutual support, solidarity, collaboration, and recognition and respect for differences. Power to is based on the belief that each individual has the power to make a difference. Power within is defined as an ability to recognize differences and respect others, grounded in a strong foundation of self-worth and self-knowledge. When we operate from a place of power within, we feel comfortable challenging assumptions and long-held beliefs, pushing against the status quo and asking if there aren't other ways to achieve the highest common good. Walking away, the far enemy of walking alongside, includes both discounting and dominating behavior such as ignoring, dismissing, power over, building walls, literally and figuratively. The last element of this theory on practicing cultivating meaningful connection is about story stewardship. And I want to start this section by acknowledging that I've been wrong about something for years. For two decades, I've said we need to understand emotion so that we can recognize it in ourselves and others. Without exaggeration, I've said this thousands of times, and I've heard it from other researchers at least that much. Well, I want to go on the record right now. I no longer believe that we can recognize emotion in other people, regardless of how well we understand human emotion and experience or how much language we have. Why have I stopped believing that we can recognize emotion in other people? Two reasons. One, too many emotions and experiences present the exact same way. There's no way really to know through observation if your tears come from grief, despair, hopelessness, or resentment, just to name a few. There's just absolutely no way. Number two, while research shows that there are some universal facial expressions for a small number of emotions, how we express what we're feeling and experiencing can be as unique as we are. So how do we know what other people are feeling? The answer is really simple and brave. We ask them. It's only then that we are able to connect with the grounded confidence to engage and the courage to walk alongside. When they tell us what they're feeling, what happened, what they fear or desire, we listen and we become trusted stewards of their stories. Story stewardship means honoring the sacred nature of story, the ones we share and the ones we hear, and knowing that we've been entrusted with something incredibly valuable, or that we have something valuable that we should treat with respect and care when we share it with others. We are good stewards of the stories we tell by trusting them to the people who've earned the right to hear them, and telling them only when we're ready. We're good stewards of the stories we hear by listening, being curious, affirming, and believing people when they tell us how they've experienced something. The near enemy of practicing story stewardship is performing connection while driving disconnection. Performative connection means that we're acting interested or invested, but there's more going on under the surface that's really driving disconnection and separation. The issues that most of us struggle with are being the knower, advice giving, and problem solving. You know, and problem solving is tough because some people do want help. The best story stewardship in these moments is just to say, I'm grateful that you're sharing this with me. What does support look like? I can listen and be with you. I can help problem solve, or whatever else you need. Just you tell me. The greatest threats to story stewardship are the two near enemies of building narrative trust: narrative takeover and narrative tap out. So rather than building trust by acknowledging, affirming, and believing, we shut people down when we experience discomfort or disinterest, or when we take over the narrative and make it about us or our perception of what happened. In your PDF, Gavin, the artist that has done this work with us, he did an incredible comic strip illustrating narrative takeover and narrative tap out. And it's so worth you taking a look at on the PDF. Narrative tap-outs can range from subtle disinterest to complete shutdowns. If they had thought bubbles, they'd say, wow, this is too uncomfortable, or I don't care enough about you to care about what you're telling me right now, or look, I can't take this on right now. If the reason we're tapping out is the latter, it's so much better to say that actually, like, I don't think I can be here for you right now for this, than to diminish someone's story. It sounds weird, but we can tap out of sharing our own stories too. Often this is about a lack of grounded confidence that our stories matter, or a lack of self-trust about when and how to share them. Tapping out of stewarding someone's story can feel like betrayal, and tapping out of sharing our own story feels like betraying ourselves. Narrative takeover is a huge problem in our world. It impacts one-on-one conversations and cultural conversations. So rather than being a good steward of story, we hijack the story and center ourselves. That centering takes on many different shapes, including shifting the focus to us, questioning or not believing what someone is sharing because it's different than our lived experience, or diminishing the importance of an experience because it makes us feel uncomfortable or worse, complicit. When we reject the truth of someone's story, the ultimate failure of story stewardship, by the way, it's often because we've stealthily centered ourselves in their story, and the narrative takeover is about protecting our ego, behavior, or privilege. The less diverse our lived experiences, the more likely we are to find ourselves struggling with narrative takeover or narrative tap out. A cultural example of narrative takeover is the Black Lives Matter movement. This is a life-affirming accountability movement to call attention to the violence being perpetrated against Black people. But rather than listening, learning, and believing the stories of injustice, systemic racism, and pain, groups of white people centered themselves with all lives matter and blue lives matter. There was never a narrative of white lives and police lives don't matter in this movement. It was an attempt to, once again, decenter Black lives and take over the narrative. Like empathy, story stewardship is not walking in someone else's shoes. It's being curious and building narrative trust as they tell you about the experience of being in their own shoes. It's about believing people when they tell you what an experience meant to them. The far enemy of narrative trust is fueling narrative distrust and diminishing the humanity of others and ourselves. Why ourselves? Because when we're reckless with people's stories, we diminish our own humanity. Once you have a chance to look at the PDF and review the model, you'll see that knowing and applying the language of human experience and emotion is a key property of all the major categories that support meaningful connection. That's how we ended up here, together sharing this book. When this emerged from the data, I thought, damn, I can't write a book on meaningful connection without including some kind of glossary or compendium of emotion and experience words. It was and remains weirdly shocking to me that access to and application of language are central to grounded competence, central to walking alongside one another, and central to story stewardship. I wouldn't have been surprised to see language emerge as core to one of these, but the fact that it's central to all three speaks to its power. The near enemy of knowing and applying language is shaping emotion and experience to fit what we know. We take nuanced experiences like despair or hopelessness and force them into whatever language we have, maybe sadness or anger. But this leaves us far less capable of sharing what we're experiencing, getting help, or moving through our experiences productively. It's a near enemy because we may be talking about our feelings or sharing them, but we can't get to healing because we're limited by our language. The far enemy is acting out, shutting down, or giving up. No access to language means we're in pain, we feel alone, and we can't articulate what's happening. In the introduction, I gave an example of trying to tell a doctor about an excruciating pain in your shoulder while your mouth is taped and your hands are tied behind your back. The limits of not being able to explain result in an unbearable level of frustration. So, Atlas of the Heart. Look, while I experienced a lot of tough moments growing up, there were also countless gifts. It sometimes feels like it has to be one or the other, but as we learned in this work, both things can be true and are often true. One of the most valuable gifts in my life was from my mom. She taught us to never look away from pain. The lesson was really simple and very clear. Don't look away. Don't look down. Don't pretend not to see hurt. Look people in the eye, even when their pain is overwhelming. And when you're hurting and you're in pain, find the people who can look you in the eye. We need to know that we're not alone, especially when we're hurting. Even in my 50s, I find myself wrestling with the same question that left me confused as a kid. Why do we cause each other so much pain, and Why do we turn away from hurt when the only way to the other side of struggle is through it? I don't know why it's so hard to understand. I've been known to run from vulnerability like someone's chasing me. Granted, not so much anymore, but it just takes so much more energy and creates so much more emotional churn than having a seat and asking hurt or uncertainty to pull up a chair. Doing this research and writing this book has taught me that our emotions and experiences are layers of biology, biography, behavior, and backstory. Every single day, our feelings and experiences show up in our bodies. They're shaped by where we come from and how we were raised. They drive how we show up, and each feeling has its own backstory. Understanding these emotions and experiences is our life's work. The more we learn, the deeper we can continue to explore. I've also learned something that has changed how I move through my life on a daily basis. Our connection with others can only be as deep as our connection with ourselves. If I don't know and understand who I am and what I need, want, and believe, I can't share myself with you. I need to be connected to myself in my own body and learning what makes me work. This is how I start to develop the grounded confidence I need to move through the world and cultivate meaningful connection with others. I think before this work, I didn't give enough importance to spending time and energy connecting to myself. I made that optional if I had anything left after connecting with others. That was not working, and now I know why. In this life, we will know and bear witness to incredible sorrow, anguish, we'll experience breathless love and joy. There will be boring days and exciting moments, low-grade disappointment and seething anger, wonder and confusion. The wild and ever-changing nature of emotions and experience leaves our hearts stretch-marked and strong, worn and willing. My hope is that we find that solid ground within us, that shore that offers safe harbor when we're feeling untethered and adrift. The more confident we are about being able to navigate to that place, the more daring our adventures, and the more connected we are to ourselves and to each other. The real gift of learning language, practicing this work, and cultivating meaningful connection is being able to go anywhere without the fear of getting lost. Even when we have no idea where we are or where we're going, with the right map, we can find our way back to our heart and to our truest self. This is Brené Brown. We hope that you've enjoyed this unabridged production of Atlas of the Heart, Mapping Meaningful Connection and the Language of Human Experience. This program was produced and directed by Karen Jakonski. It was engineered by Danny Reeves at Wire Road Studios in Houston. It was edited by Tim Bader Audio. Text copyright 2021 by Brené Brown. Grateful acknowledgement is made to HarperCollins Publishers for permission to reprint brief excerpts from page 27 and 90 through 91 of All About Love by Bell Hooks. Copyright 2000 by Gloria Watkins. Used by permission of HarperCollins Publishers. Production copyright 2022, Penguin Random House, LLC. All rights reserved.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.